if we take enough fire. We may be destroyed or merely disabled, depending on Omicron's orders." The holograms began firing tiny projectiles that disappeared into the air in front of them. They spun around and flew in tiny loops, demonstrating combat maneuvers. "How am I supposed to avoid these things?" Lucas asked.
"How am I supposed to kill them?" added Asha.
Alpha closed the hologram. "It will not be easy. We are a transport ship and not nearly as maneuverable as a fighter, nor with as much firepower. Our sole advantage is that the new core allows us to move more quickly than the craft could previously."
"So just dodge and weave," Lucas said.
"I am not a combat pilot, but yes, that would likely be advisable."
"And I'm still using the same gun as I did there?"
Asha said, motioning toward town.
"Only at extremely close range. Though the main gun is offline, it would not have mattered, as the drones are too small and fast. But your arsenal has expanded, as you now have access to a stockpile of missiles."
Asha was taken aback.
"We had missiles this entire time, and you weren't letting me use them?"
"There was no reason to unleash them on the village when the light gun served its purpose. Furthermore, they are designed for extra-orbital combat, and I knew we would need to employ them in our escape attempt."
Alpha was once again logical, but it didn't make Asha any less annoyed.
"Additionally, I will join you in the secondary turret. The engine is now more stable than it has ever been, and we will need all the firepower we can gather to avoid destruction by the sentries."
"I thought you weren't a soldier," Lucas asked.
"I knew this day would come, and I have trained myself accordingly. Do not concern yourself with my abilities. Additionally, there is no longer a chance of our weapons overheating."
"Thank God for that," Asha said.
"So what's the plan, kill all these robots and turn on hyperdrive?" asked Lucas.
"What is this hyperdrive?" Alpha said, confused.
"The new core, it makes us go faster than light, right?"
Alpha looked amused.
"Your notions of science are derived from your fiction, not fact. The core does not make us go faster to travel at range. You have heard of what you call wormholes in space and time?"
"Yes."
"The core generates a pathway that we will travel through that will cut through the galaxy to our destination. Going faster would have all of us dead of old age before we even reached, much less. This way will still take some time, but substantially less than 1,000,000 years.
Was that sarcasm? Couldn't be.
"So, how does that work?" asked Asha.
Alpha was the one starting to look annoyed.
"From interacting with the pair of you, it is obvious neither of you are well versed in the sciences. But even if you were, attempting to convey the elaborate and exact concepts behind intergalactic travel to even a genius of your civilization would be as if you were to try to explain how one of your airplanes functioned to an ancient ancestor more intimately familiar with the workings of sticks and stones."
Lucas didn't appreciate the condescension, but he knew he probably couldn't understand the depth of Alpha's knowledge, even if he was Einstein or Hawking.
"All right. No need to be a dick about it," Asha said. "When are we getting off this rock?"
"Presently," said Alpha. "Report to stations."
When Lucas fired the ship up this time, things were different. Taking off in open air rather than underground was certainly a relief, but it was more than that. The controls were responding much more quickly, and green 100% indicators lit up across the board, which revealed that every primary system on the ship was now surging at full power. The thrust of the engines was more powerful than ever, and as he left the ground with ease, he found that the ship felt a great deal lighter than it had previously. The weight had obviously not changed, but the integration of the new core had given the Ark a complete overhaul, and it felt like an entirely new ship. Lucas watched the ravaged town at Qualia disappear below him. The place had almost been his tomb on more than one occasion over the past few days, and he was glad to be rid of it. but it occurred to him that the horrible little village was the last place on earth where he would ever set foot. And he regretted not savoring the moment a little more, even if the place was a hellhole. Turning his attention to the cloud cover, Lucas found it to be quite a bit higher in the atmosphere than he had anticipated. They were rising rapidly, and had been for some time, but had not yet broken through it. Alpha and Asha were visible in two floating monitors to his right and left. His hands swirled around through ship status reports and diagnostics so quickly he was barely conscious of what he was doing. It was the virtual training at work again, and his brain was firing even faster than his hands. Hopefully the ship would allow him to process information that rapidly when avoiding sentinels in a short while. Finally, the arc broke through the clouds. Lucas was speechless. The sun shone as brightly as it ever had, and the bluish-black sky was a stark contrast to the red swirling clouds below it. To the east, Lucas could even see half of the moon in the distance. Earth's old friends were still there as they'd always been, watching as the planet slowly decayed. It was miraculous to see them once again. He never thought he would. They kept rising, and the blue turned darker and darker, and stars began to appear in the distance. The ship rumbled, and Lucas could see the hull turn a fiery red as they broke through what was left of the corroding atmosphere. Amidst all the carnage and heartbreak and despair he'd experienced in the last few years, this moment was simply glorious. He remembered watching the space shuttle launch from Cape Canaveral with his father as a boy. Soon after, he went through a prolonged phase of wanting to do nothing but be an astronaut, to go and see the stars and come back and tell everyone about them. Now he was actually going there, at the helm of an alien starship. His childhood self could not have imagined anything more spectacular. His perfect moment was cut short by Alpha on the monitor.
"Do you see them?"
Lucas checked his readouts and saw that two of the rotating satellite stations Alpha had showed them earlier had been detected nearby. Zooming in on the view screen, he scanned the star-filled horizon until the computer located and outlined both of them.
"Increase speed," Alpha said.
Lucas dialed up the engines and was temporarily pinned back in his seat. He glanced over at Noah, who was still in his cylinder on the floor a short distance away, with no time to move him to his new quarters in the brig. Alpha assured them that the ship's artificial gravity system would keep them in place and minimize G-force, no matter how elaborate their maneuvers in space. The curved edge of Earth was now visible in the view screen, and, as Lucas suspected, the cloud cover stretched far and wide over the horizon. Earth probably looked more vibrant from this angle back when it was a mass of green and blue, but it was still an undeniably impressive sight. Lucas couldn't savor it for long. As the arc moved further out into space, he could see the two stations drifting to either side of the view screen. He was going to pass right through them. Was it possible Alpha was wrong? Maybe they had been left offline with the planet in ruin, as there was nothing of substance to report. No one breathed as they moved silently through the pair of sentinels. The speed readout said the Ark was traveling at close to 200,000 miles an hour, but it felt like he was riding a raft down a lazy river. Noah had apparently even fallen back asleep. Alarms everywhere. The game was up. Half-translated danger readouts flashed in front of Lucas's eyes. He scrambled to see what exactly was going on, but could only make out the words enemy and approach. The sentinels were behind him now, but one of his monitors with a rear view of the ship showed what was happening. He flung it up on the main view screen. Robotic drone fighters streamed out of the stations like hornets from a disturbed nest. It was impossible to tell just how many of them were pouring forth from each station, but what was clear was that they were approaching fast, even as Lucas increased their speed to 500,000. "Here we go," he yelled into the monitor, and he tried to silence some of the proximity alarms that were blaring in his ears. He was flying away from Earth, but the view screen continued to show the view to the rear. The planet was almost entirely encircled by cloud cover, with a few rare areas showing brown or dark red blotches. More pressing, however, were the objects in the foreground as the drone fighters were gaining on them. Alpha fired the first missile, knowing their range and capability more intimately than Asha. The canister burned a bright blue and spiraled toward a cluster of sentinel drones. They attempted to scatter, but the detonation consumed two of them while three others spun crazily out of control, heavily damaged. Asha didn't waste any time after seeing Alpha unload and launched a missile of her own.
The drones reacted more quickly this time, but one was incinerated and another injured so that it fell back, unable to pursue. It was their turn. The foremost drones fired a stream of shots that Lucas had to dodge entirely through reflex. Without the added neural stimulation of the captain's chair, he doubted he would have reacted in time. But using the hollow controls wrapped around his arms, he wrenched the ship to the right, avoiding the stream of fire. The battle escalated quickly as more and more drones caught up. Asha and Alpha were now firing missiles in sequence, and through a pair of small monitors to his left, Lucas could see their targeting system cycling through possible bogeys and then deploying the missiles once there was a lock. Drones were going down, but they were incredibly nimble, and on occasion would be able to dodge the missiles entirely, which would shoot past them toward Earth, growing ever smaller. Their speed was now well over a million, but all systems appeared to be holding. Lucas spun right to avoid another series of blasts from the drones. Even when the ship was upside down, the internal gravity didn't change at all, and Lucas imagined he was feeling far less nauseous than he would be at the helm of a human fighter jet. The battle was fraying his nerves, however, and he could feel his heart beating in his throat. Every split second he was dodging more fire. As increasing numbers swarmed the ship, he couldn't avoid them all, and the arc started taking hits. Blasts peppered the hull, and readouts flashed at him angrily. He scrambled to try and fix the affected systems on the fly. Mercifully, there had been no breaches yet. Missiles continued to rip the drones apart, but some had managed to get along the sides of the ship despite its ever-increasing speeds. Asha caught on, switched to the manual turret, and unloaded into three on the port side. When they were in pieces, she did a complete 180 and tore apart four more starboard. Alpha 2 switched to the turret's cannon and blasted a few spindly drones that were moving dangerously close to the engines. The Ark was traveling at 5 million miles an hour, and Lucas wondered what the upward limit was with a new core. Earth was barely visible, and he hadn't even had time to notice they were approaching a dull, reddish-orange orb in the distance. Mars, Lucas realized, but was jolted by another series of blasts connecting with the hull. He spun the ship around for three full rotations to avoid further impact. "Will you hold the damn thing steady for 2 seconds?" Asha yelled through the monitor. "I'm trying to kill these things." "I'm trying to keep them from killing us," Lucas shot back. Two more drones blew apart, and it appeared Asha was making do. Lucas switched the main view screen to a frontal view once more, and his blood instantly chilled as he saw a formation of four drones heading toward him, each unloading all three cannons at once. Their initial volley hit, but Lucas quickly jerked the ship straight up to arc over the rest of their fire. Only stars were in view now, but the arc was immediately rocked by a huge impact. The readout in front of his face read, "Collision," followed by an even more terrifying notification, "Hull breach, cargo bay." Lucas immediately checked the seal was still intact on the bay door and breathed a sigh of relief when he saw that the rest of the ship wasn't compromised. Had one of the drones actually hit them? What else could collision mean? Checking readouts, it became clear one of the advancing drones had connected with the underside of the ship, where both turrets were. The monitors revealed both Asha and Alpha were still present and accounted for, but Alpha's turret had a multitude of warning lights surrounding it. "Alpha, what happened? Are you all right?" Alpha launched another missile into a drone cluster. "This station was weakened by that impact. I must abandon the post before it gives way completely." He shot a barrage that tore the wing off a passing fighter. "I will move to the engine bay and prepare us for our final departure." "And when exactly is that?" Lucas asked, dodging another volley from the rear. "We must be further away from your sun," Alpha replied coolly, even as the ship took fire all around him. "That will require holding off the sentries for a short while longer." "Fantastic," Asha said, as one of her shots failed to connect. Alpha left his turret as the danger indicators attached to it continued to look more and more dire. Now the Ark had half the firepower, but it seemed as if the drones were finally thinning out. They still buzzed around the ship, but there were no more large clusters, and their automated formations seemed to be growing sloppy. Lucas wondered if they were too far away from their central stations. Were they even meant to travel this far? Was their own ship? The Ark was now moving through space at 20 million miles an hour and was starting to shake a bit. Whether it was the speed or recent damage they'd taken, Lucas couldn't be sure.
He kept swerving to avoid fire, and another collision indicator told him he'd clipped a drone on the right, though it was a heavily armored part of the ship, and he'd done no actual damage to their craft. Asha kept picking off straggling drones, and a readout indicated that she was almost out of missiles. They'd launched almost their entire supply in their escape attempt, and as the Ark was meant to be a transport above all else, there wasn't anything else in the arsenal to turn to. Lining up a shaky formation of three drones, Asha launched a precious missile, and as all three machines erupted, she could see it was well spent. A new monitor showed that Alpha had reached the engine bay and was swirling controls around near the core. Lucas looked at his turret and found the danger readouts had reached critical mass. Shit! The weakened view screen of the turret bay shattered, and the entire gun was ripped from the bottom of the ship and flung into space. It stunned Lucas, but he quickly saw that there had been no depressurization of the nearby passageways, with the area sealing itself off automatically. He breathed a sigh of relief, but halfway through exhaling, had to jerk the ship away from another barrage of incoming fire. Trying to keep track of every angle of the ship via a string of monitors was extremely difficult, and it was compounded by all the floating readouts of the ship's various systems in differing levels of distress. He was constantly racing back and forth between them, all the while steering the ship away from fire, and he was certain he wouldn't be able to keep up without his enhanced cognitive functioning. Despite all their weaving, the cables remained embedded to his temples and were likely the only thing preventing his brain from shutting down due to an overabundance of information. He took a split second to glance back toward Noah's cylinder bed, but couldn't see him over the lip. He turned to the other side of the chair and tried to see if he was crawling around somewhere, but there was no sign of him. Could a child that age even crawl yet? Lucas was snapped back into reality by another drone speeding at him from the front. He dodged the Trigun assault and watched it explode as he and Asha were apparently on the same page for once. 30 million and rising, Mars lay suspended before him, its red coloring unmistakable. They were a long way from home now, and the planet grew larger as they sped toward it. It was a breathtaking sight, but as it grew bigger, Alpha chimed in on the comm. "Please refrain from striking that planet." Lucas took offense to Alpha's estimation of his piloting abilities. He veered the ship to the right and watched Mars slowly pass them by in silence. It was too silent, actually. Lucas scanned his various monitors and saw that the Sentinel drones had stopped firing and had all fallen to the rear of the ship, keeping their distance. "What the hell are they doing?" Asha said. And she stopped firing as the drones were now too far out for turret fire and too spread out for missiles. Lucas switched the main view screen to look forward once again and saw a strange sight. Of the hundreds of thousands of stars that populated his forward view, there was a distinct section that was completely black. It was like the space had swallowed up everything around it, and all that was left was complete and utter darkness. A black hole? No. Even with Lucas's limited scientific knowledge, he was certain there were no black holes within the solar system itself. He called down to Alpha, who was still near the core. "Are you seeing this, Alpha?" Alpha pulled up a monitor and saw the darkness for himself. He immediately sprinted over to another console and furiously whirred the fingers of both his claws. When he spoke, his voice had an urgency Lucas couldn't remember ever hearing before. "Asha, fire all remaining missiles in succession at these coordinates!" He flung some data to a screen, and it popped up in front of Asha.
"The computer says there's nothing at that point," she said.
"Override immediately," Alpha said, his metallic voice as close as it could get to yelling. Asha unleashed a stream of 5 missiles, their last 5, and they shot out into space ahead of them. They trailed each other in a helix pattern until the lights of their propulsion systems were too dim to see and then disappeared into the black void. "So what did—" Asha was cut off by an explosion that lit up the view screen. The missiles had collided with their target, and the dark void flickered ahead of them until a distinct shape came into view. A ship. It was sleek and black, and though the missiles had disabled its cloaking field so it was now visible, it reflected the surrounding starlight so well that it was still camouflaged. It was longer and thinner than their craft, but Lucas couldn't estimate its true size. He turned to his holoscreen, but there was no data for the ship the way there had been for the mothership and Sentinels. Just a jumble of incomprehensible symbols.
As they drew closer, Lucas could see where they'd damaged it with their blind missile barrage. But even injured, blue lights were beginning to spool up in front of the ship. Suddenly, the view screen changed. Omicron. The menacing black creature growled something, and Lucas's readout gave him an extremely rough translation. Only two English words appeared out of the mess of symbols.
Return. Home.
On the monitor, Alpha flicked his claw through a virtual switch. The white core glowed brightly, and every light in the ship went out, the main screen along with them. In an instant, everything came back online, and the view screen exploded with blinding white, purple, and blue light that seared Lucas's retinas. Omicron's ship was nowhere to be found. The neural enhancers detached themselves from Lucas's temples, and he immediately lost consciousness in the chair. Chapter 12. He was jostled awake on a bench by a blurry shape in front of him. A face soon came into focus. Adam. Around him was a grassy park, and in the distance a recently risen sun. Another reality, one already past. Adam spoke.
Hey, Lucas, you all right?
Adam flashed a brilliant smile as he put his hand on Lucas's shoulder and sat down next to him. He was in his dress blues that echoed his eyes and had a slew of decorations on his chest Lucas couldn't identify, though he'd heard tales around the dinner table of what he'd done to get them. The fact that he was here at all was a miracle in itself.
Yeah, I'm fine, Lucas replied. It's just been a long week.
Lucas adjusted his bow tie. His shirt was too tight around the neck and felt like it was choking him. He undid the top button in surrender. Adam was still tanned from his trip overseas, though his blonde hair had grown back and was not the close-cropped buzz cut it had been when he left. It was perfectly trimmed and swept in an arc to the side, his white hat in his other hand. His ceremonial sword was perfectly polished. Not a fiber of his entire ensemble was out of place.
That's understandable. It's been a whirlwind, I imagine, he said.
You have no idea. The Portland breeze grazed his face. July was one of the few months it truly felt like summer here. It really was a perfect day, and they couldn't have been luckier.
How are you feeling after last night? Adam asked.
Lucas rubbed his head instinctively.
I'm good. Things got pretty out of control there for a while, even for a bachelor party.
Adam's smile dimmed a bit.
I know. I'm sorry.
Adam looked out toward the city.
She's my sister. I need to know you're going to take care of her when I'm away.
I will. I promise.
I know you will, he said earnestly, without a hint of a threat. Behind them, men and women scrambled around, setting up white folding chairs in an outdoor park.
A gazebo was coated in more flowers than Lucas could count. A tiny barefoot girl in a yellow dress went running down the empty aisle. Lucas turned back toward Adam.
I'm afraid, Lucas whispered.
He was ashamed to admit that to someone so brave, but he had no one else to turn to. Adam had been a good friend during the past few months, and Lucas couldn't help but admire him. He was a greater man than Lucas could ever hope to be.
He who sees all beings in his own self, and his own self in all beings, loses all fear.
Lucas looked at Adam incredulously.
Where'd you get that from?
Adam laughed, his broad smile returning.
It's Hindu. Don't tell my mother.
Lucas chuckled.
What I mean is that once you marry her, you're one with her. If you can see yourself in her and realize that she's now a part of you, the fear will fade, as you can conquer it as one.
He adjusted his decorative sword, which was poking through the slats of the bench.
It may sound like crap, but it's helped me a lot with Grace when I've been away. She's what helps me get past the fear over there. It's not only about survival. You need something to be fighting for.
He took a breath and ran a white-gloved hand over his hair.
I know you have your own struggles, but now you're fighting for her. You're fighting to be the man she needs.
Adam was such a stand-up guy, it almost made Lucas sick. Or perhaps that was the handle of Jack from the previous night. But he was right.
Anyway, we've got to go. Sonya's almost ready.
Thanks, Adam.
Anytime.
No, really, I mean it. Lucas extended his hand. Adam shook it firmly, then stood up and hoisted Lucas to his feet. He stood a few inches shorter than Lucas, but he never felt like the smaller man. Ahead of them, people were starting to trickle in and take their seats. In the distance, a large white tent stood rooted to the ground by a few dozen stakes. A bridesmaid opened the flap to walk in, and Lucas caught a glimpse of her. Sonya was standing there in her radiant white dress, as women swirled around her, touching up her makeup and making sure her blonde hair remained in place. Even at this distance, the sight was breathtaking. The flap closed, and Lucas turned back to Adam. But he was gone. In front of him, the guests had all disappeared as well, and the entire park was empty. The blue sky turned red, a nearby fountain evaporated in a hiss of steam. Lucas awoke in a pod, a halo rising up from his head. Another memory, which he'd realized as he'd been living it. But again, the sound of Adam's voice and the breeze lingered for a moment before all traces of them faded. At least this thing wasn't necessarily a nightmare machine. That had hardly been a traumatic moment, though it was one that stayed with him. It was the last time he would see Adam before he shipped off to Afghanistan again the next day. At least the pod hadn't thrust him into the terrible day 6 months later when Sonya got a phone call and collapsed to the floor in a crying heap. Lucas's stomach knotted even thinking about it. Adam deserved better than to die in a desert during a conflict no one understood. Had he lived until the creatures showed up, no doubt he would have been leading the first retaliation strike force as soon as they opened fire. It would have been a slightly more noble death. As strong as he was, he wouldn't have survived in the world after the war. He had too much honor, and the wretched souls who remained would have killed him for it. And Sonya. The memories were so vivid, it was like he'd actually gotten to see her again, if only at a distance. Before the fights, before the tears. The day in the park had been fantastic, one of the best of his life. But reliving it? It pained him to see Sonya and Adam again, especially when they'd seemed so real. Even if it didn't constantly plague him with the horrors of his past, this machine was still dangerous. The translucent door slid up, and he found himself facing Asha in the pod across from him. She was visibly upset, and as she stepped down from the platform, her legs buckled, and she had to steady herself. "How the hell did I get in that thing again?" she asked, her voice shaking. Lucas's legs were a bit wobbly as well, and he reached out and grabbed a nearby pod for support. "I've no idea. What's the last thing you remember?"
"That ship. The message. That light."
"Same here."
"Then I woke up in a memory."
Lucas turned to notice one of the pods had been ripped out of the wall and placed horizontally on the ground. It was still connected to the wall with cables, but the door was shut, and the inside appeared to be filled with some sort of gas. A dark shape moved within.
"Holy shit!"
Lucas exclaimed as he dropped to his knees, understanding what was in the pod. As he drew closer, he could see the door was trying to open, but the mechanism was stuck. He gripped it and pulled upward with as much force as he could muster, which wasn't a lot given that his arms felt as weak as his legs. Finally, the door popped open on his third try, and the gas dissipated in an instant. In the gelatinous backing lay Noah, looking groggy but unharmed. He thrashed his hands and feet around and let out a large yawn. It was as active as they'd seen him. His burned arm and shoulder looked noticeably better. Asha bent down to pick him up, and he threw his arms around her neck. But she was still scowling as she turned to Lucas. "Where's Alpha?" They found him on the bridge, sifting through a giant grid of symbols projecting from the central holotable. Asha marched up to him and set Noah squarely in the middle of the display.
"What happened?" she asked sternly. "Why did we all wake up in those nightmare boxes?"
Clearly, her vision was far more jarring than Lucas's had been.
"I am pleased to see you are refreshed after your slumber," Alpha said,
a baby now obstructing his view of the symbols.
"Our slumber?"
Lucas asked.
How long were we in there?
A mere 3 days.
3 days? It had seemed like only a matter of minutes.
I placed you in the... after our escape attempt. The intensity of the actions you performed caused your bodies to shut down when they were disconnected from the ship. The controls were not designed with your neurological systems in mind, and you lost consciousness immediately afterward following the prolonged combat experience.
And what about him? Asha said, motioning to Noah, who was gazing up at the moving symbols all around him with a smile. It was the first one they'd seen him wear.
The child insisted on constantly crying once you both were away. I do not know how to raise your young. Rest, medicine, and nutrients should have satiated him. The same is true for the both of you.
Nutrients. That's what the gas was in Noah's pod. And they'd been absorbing them as well. Lucas's stomach felt empty, but he wasn't hungry, and despite some lightheadedness, he felt more energetic. He also noticed his leg and ribs barely hurt anymore. And Noah had been crying? That was a first. Why didn't we have to rest after the aerial village raid? Lucas asked.
That was a far simpler task. Escaping Earth and engaging the Sentinels required complexities far beyond that of the first assault, and your brains had to be stimulated to the point of collapse in order to be able to maintain focus.
Lucas remembered how his mind had raced to keep track of the controls, readouts, and array of monitors during the engagement. Asha likely had as much on her plate as she tried to shoot down dozens of fighters while traveling at a few million miles per hour.
You regained consciousness in the... a day ago. But I kept you suspended for a while longer to ensure your full recovery. I would have thought you would be grateful.
Those things, Asha said. They're not meant for us.
More hallucinations?
Alpha asked, bemused. That's not what they are, Asha said coldly. Lucas changed the subject.
What happened to Omicron? What was that light?
The coordinates I gave you were the precise location of his ship's central power node. The missile barrage caught his defenses unaware and hopefully disabled it for a period that will allow us to reach our destination without capture.
How did you know exactly where their power source was? I couldn't even see a ship there at all.
My father designed that vessel and its cloaking system. It was built as a unique craft for the High Commander and presented to him as a reward for winning the siege of... It is one of the most advanced units in the entire fleet, and we were fortunate to catch it off guard in the manner we did.
Noah was now swatting at the holographic symbols on the table excitedly. It was the most engaged he'd ever been with anything. It appeared the pod agreed with him, if not with them. He came all the way here to get you himself? And why didn't they just blow us up instead of hiding?
I have perhaps underestimated the significance of whatever my father did that brought about the destruction of my clan. The fact that we are alive implies they need to capture, not kill me, at least temporarily. Why, I do not know.
I bet he'd tell you, Asha said, if he wants to speak with you so badly.
Perhaps, but I fear after I was informed and forced to aid them in some way, I would be executed or enslaved, and it is obvious you three would be expendable even if I was needed alive.
We're an endangered species. Doesn't that count for anything? Lucas said, half joking.
It does not.
Alpha seemed to only have a sense of humor when it suited him. And where exactly are we? Asha asked. The view screen was full of data and readouts, not stars or the celestial fabric of space. Alpha swirled a switch next to the squirming Noah, who reached out and tried to grab at his claw. The view screen's display was wiped, and a soft glow of blue, purple, white, and green light shone in front of them. You activated the core, Lucas said, though he'd already guessed it.
I did, and yet we live.
There were no shapes to be found in the ether, just hazy patches of light. It reminded Lucas of the one time he'd caught a glimpse of the Aurora Borealis on a flight across Canada. Alpha swiped the controls again, the data reappeared, and the hypnotizing display of colors vanished.
And what about Omicron?
Lucas asked.
It will take him some time to repair his ship. He will likely have to call for maintenance assistance and a new core which will set him back even further behind us. Though that does not mean he cannot catch us once we are out of...
Out of what?
You do not have a word for this state. How to describe it? The in-between. Space between space. We are on a path that transcends space-time, allowing us to travel great distances in a short span.
And how much time is that exactly? Asha asked. Alpha paused for a minute to think. He brought up some data on the monitor, much to Noah's delight.
In relative Earth time, 5 months.
5 months? We're stuck in this coffee can for 5 months?
Would you prefer 500,000 years?
Alpha replied with an audible snort.
Dilation shrinks the perceived time of the journey, but it will feel like 158 days to you.
Lucas realized now was the time to ask the question that had been dodged for a week now.
Alpha, for the love of God, where are we going?
Chapter 13. After a long pause, Alpha spoke.
We are defecting.
Noah was crawling dangerously close to the edge of the hollow table. Lucas scooped him up before he got any further.
Defecting? To where? To who?
Asha asked. Alpha hesitated again.
You may not be able to process this information. It is something we still do not fully understand.
What are you talking about? Asked Lucas. Noah squirmed in his arms, trying to get back to the table.
I suppose it would be best to show you, to explain. I must integrate the language into my translator.
Alpha adjusted a few symbols on the tiny hologram protruding from his collar, and then sifted through a few readouts on the table. Suddenly, a three-dimensional picture of a woman's head appeared. She was silver-haired, with fair skin and blue eyes, and looked to be about 60. Lucas and Asha were confused.
Who is this? Lucas asked.
Talis Vale, ruler of Sora.
Sora?
Sora.
Alpha brought up a hologram of a large green and blue planet with unrecognizable continents surrounded by vast oceans. Lucas understood.
No.
It was impossible.
They're human?
Asha looked astonished as the stern-faced woman rotated slowly in front of them.
Sauron is what they call themselves, but yes, your genetic makeup and biology is almost identical to theirs.
Alpha brought up a hologram of a cross-section of two human males, though one was presumably Sauron. Lucas scanned both, but could see almost no difference between them. He only counted one kidney on the Sauron and two fewer ribs, but no other marked dissimilarities jumped out at him.
Incredible! How is this possible?
The hologram of the woman reappeared.
A common ancestor, presumably, though we have not been able to trace the exact location or nature of their origin.
Next to the woman, a smaller depiction of her planet spun in a slow rotation.
This is who you're fighting your war against? More humans?
Lucas asked.
Saurons, but yes. And it is a war that has plagued us for a long time. Too long.
He brought up another holographic sphere. This one was a dark red planet with only hints of blue and green. Lucas recognized it from the bridge of the mothership.
This is the planet the Saurons call Zala. To us it is... It is my home.
Lucas couldn't tell if it was disgust or reverence that was in Alpha's black and gold eyes.
The two planets are a mere 10 trillion miles away, using your own system of measures. The proximity has allowed the war to be fierce and constant, but never truly winnable by either side. The conflict has raged for many millennia now, and is only growing more intense with the passage of time.
Asha finally spoke for the first time, having absorbed all the recent incredible information. Why are you at war?
At first it was to survive, but now it seems the greatest motivator is purely revenge.
Revenge? For what?
It is a story that's been passed down for generations. Many ages ago, the Saurians found our civilization soon after intergalactic travel across space-time was discovered. We welcomed their arrival and embraced their wondrous technology, which was ages ahead of our own. They called the planet Zala and us Zalans. In their tongue, the word means strange and stranger, while Sora means home.
Images were playing on the larger view screen now. It was a video of Saurians landing in a large spacecraft. They were dressed in bulky metal suits that covered every inch of their body, including their faces. They were greeted by Zalans, or creatures as Lucas knew them.
But as the decades went by, it became clear that our planet was more valuable than we were. Posing as friends, they siphoned off all our resources, including our most precious one, water.
A rich, lush planet on screen slowly decayed into the red rock that was Zala.
After 100 years of being trampled, we decided to fight back. Our revolution was bloody and swift, and though we suffered huge losses, we eventually drove them from our planet. But the damage was done. Zala barely had enough resources to carry on, and the dwindling population had to make do.
The screen showed a wretched bunch of Zalans in a dilapidated city full of strange-looking buildings. The screen then jumped to scientists working in haphazardly constructed labs.
It should have driven us to ruin, but it drove us to ingenuity instead.
Wait, Asha interrupted. Why did they need to take your resources and all your water? They've got oceans full.
Yes, that is true, and more than you could know. Here is the actual scale of these planetary bodies.
He flipped a holo switch back at the table, and three planets appeared. Zala was small, a tightly packed ball of red. Next to it was Earth, a little larger, implying the dark planet was a touch smaller than Mars. But Sora? It was massive, a half dozen times the size of Earth at least, and looked to be comparable to a body like Neptune.
Sora is resource-rich, and they did not take our water, they destroyed it, along with negating the formation of nearly all the clouds that would produce more.
Why?
To prevent us from reaching their level of scientific progress. To avoid us becoming a threat by unlocking the mystery of cross-system and intergalactic travel.
What do you mean? What mystery?
Water. There is a reason finding the resource in large quantities across the universe is so exceedingly rare. Combined with a certain synthetic element which your race had not yet discovered, it is a power source far more incredible than any you could ever imagine, and has the ability to open a rift in space-time when utilized properly.
Water? This ship and all your ships are powered by water? Asha scoffed. Lucas thought of the tanks below and his makeshift quarters.
I know of your planet's scientific history. You were likely a long ways off from discovering the process for yourselves if you did not destroy each other first.
No, you did that for us, said Asha coldly. Alpha ignored her.
I do not expect you to believe what I am saying or understand how the process works, but I assure you it does.
Water. The idea was preposterous, but suddenly something became clear. Our oceans. That's why you came here. That's why you invaded us. You needed our water to help fight your war. Alpha nodded.
Eventually, despite a lack of resources, our scientists discovered the process to create the cores needed for long-range travel. When the Saurians learned we had invented the technology, they returned to attempt to wipe us out entirely, but we were ready.
The screen showed an enormous space battle, with types of ships Lucas had never seen before firing at each other.
We held against the onslaught, but knew we could never best them completely with our home world's now limited resources.
Alpha paused, and then brought up the bust of a Zalan on the hollow table.
My clan was gifted with intellect, and generations ago my ancestors were responsible for the research that eventually allowed us to travel further and further out into space. Technology that the Sorens did not even possess, we were able to find other habitable planets with resources near our region of the galaxy, not many, but enough to help fuel us in our ongoing struggle. A litany of worlds were flung up next to Sora, Zala, and Earth on the hollow table. A few had large areas of blue, but were quite a bit smaller than any of the others. The ones that were close to Earth's size had far less water, and were almost entirely brown with only select patches of blue. When we arrived, we were amazed. He brought up another video feed on the main view screen. More Sorens. The archival footage showed a group of dark-skinned tribal humans clutching elaborately carved spears and wearing armor made of bark. It was not until we annihilated them that we knew they were not tied to Sora at all. The same species simply existed on planets across the sector. We lay siege to all of them, and not one put up a fight. How could they? The view screen showed an astonishing sight. Playing were five separate videos of battles that showed Zalan ships and soldiers raining fire on human civilizations. A planet spun in the corner of each feed, named by unidentifiable symbols. One showed the tribesmen throwing spears at drone fighters. Another was a medieval-looking castle under attack by spaceships. To the right, a large stone palace was crumbling as foot soldiers brandished swords and shields against hordes of creatures approaching in power armor. Next to that was an army of infantrymen wearing ornate metal armor, marching in formation while firing odd-looking mechanical guns and hoisting flags full of bizarre designs. The last view screen simply showed nude humans with matted, stringy hair, waving wood clubs and flinging rocks at Zalan ships flying far overhead. The entire display was surreal. Their civilizations were infantile. Despite their biological similarity to Sorens, they possessed not a fraction of their technology. It was not a war, but a slaughter. Each new planet we discovered managed to fuel our conflict for another era, and then there was Earth. A familiar-looking globe appeared on the view screen as the battle scenes faded. Earth looked the way Zala once did, according to record. It had far more water than any habitable planet we had discovered and raided previously. It could have been the key to our ultimate victory rather than the disaster it was. The view screen showed a shot of the original creature ship hovering above New York. We underestimated your civilization's technological progress. Though your space travel capabilities were pitiful, we did not anticipate your ability to destroy. Imagine a civilization that would willingly keep weapons that could annihilate itself 1,000 times over. Incredible. The screen flickered with battle scenes from the assault on Earth. Mushroom clouds erupted across the landscape as Zalan ships disintegrated. We sent reinforcements, but not enough, and not as quickly as we should have. Once we understood the full capability of your nuclear weapons and how they interacted with our own antimatter bombs, your planet was poisoned by the ensuing fallout. The clouds, Lucas said. The water. All rendered useless in the aftermath of the war. Not only did we sustain heavy military losses, but we only managed to extract limited resources before they were corrupted completely. I do not know how the botched campaign was received back home, but I would imagine it has been a significant setback for the war effort. Just a minute, Asha said, her arms folded in front of her. If you were discovering all these habitable planets, why didn't you just relocate there after mopping up the local wildlife? Why continue the war? Alpha brought up the five other planets beside Earth once more. This has been the subject of debate for many years now. We do, in fact, have colonies on many of these worlds, as they've helped to alleviate the issue of our rapid population growth. But the ruling council decrees that the war must continue until Sora is ours. The Sorens must not be forgiven for what they did to us, and their rich planet is the crown jewel of the galaxy, which they do not deserve.
You don't sound like you believe that.
My clan has always been wary of such claims. For generations we have worked for the betterment of the Zalin race, and war improves the lives of no one. While there is a sect that wishes for all our people to leave Zala and migrate to these new worlds, the ruling party, which has been in power for thousands of years, demands Zala hold firm as a military force to be supplied by the other planets. The vast majority of Zalans believe wholeheartedly this arrangement must continue. Our species has been battle-born for thousands of years, and war is all we know. Pride has killed more Zalans than Sora ever did.
Intergalactic war that lasted millennia. A mammoth planet full of humans. Even with all Lucas had experienced over the past few years, it was a lot to take in. He understood why Alpha had needed a quiet moment to explain it all to them. "Where do we fit into all this?" Lucas asked.
Alpha brought up the original hologram of the woman once more.
"We will go to Sora. I will offer Talis Vale all my knowledge of the Zolans and our military operations both on and off-world. I also possess the knowledge that would allow them to travel further than they have ever been into deep space. I would be infinitely valuable to them."
"They'd raid your colonies," Asha said.
Alpha sighed.
"It is a risk I must take. The war must end one way or another. Omicron and the Council must not be allowed to continue plotting this course toward mutual destruction. The war may be ended without the annihilation of either side. I believe uncovering my father's research will be key to understanding the solution I seek. I believe it is why he was killed."
"And what about us?" Lucas asked.
"You will astonish them the way they have astonished you. They have not seen these other worlds full of creatures like them. They know nothing of Earth. To learn they are not the only Sorens in the universe will undoubtedly be a shattering revelation, and they will want to hear everything you have to say about your world."
"And showing up in this Zalin hunk of junk, they're not just going to blow us out of the sky?" Asha asked.
"I hope they would be more curious than vengeful when they encounter as strange a phenomenon as two of their own piloting the craft in tandem with their enemy," Alpha said.
"You hope?"
Lucas asked.
"Hope is the basis for this entire endeavor."
Lucas lay on his mattress in the water chamber, clad in new khaki cargo pants and a black t-shirt from the mansion. His head was still reeling from all Alpha had told them about Sora, Zala, and the eternal conflict they were now squarely in the middle of. Nearby, Noah was playing with the only toy that interested him. It was the disc Alpha had given Lucas when they'd gone into the mothership, and the child was waving his arms excitedly through the various maps and interfaces, giggling as they changed shape before him. Having broken out of his sullen state, Noah would certainly help to improve morale if he began to develop as a normal child would. Lucas's quarters had needed some reorganizing, as even with the artificial gravity of the ship, his stacks of books had been thrown across the floor during the Sentinel firefight, and Natalie had fallen off of her perch above his bed. He remounted the rifle and ran his finger through the gaping metal wound once more. It still pained him to see his old friend mangled so. Lucas browsed through a data disk Alpha had given him after their chat on the bridge. It contained a large amount of Zalan-gathered information on their destination, Sora, and Alpha had advised the pair of them to study it closely. Thumbing through the basic information, he found the planet's vital statistics. Sora was about 40,000 miles in diameter, which dwarfed Earth's 8,000. It took the equivalent of 486 Earth days to orbit around the central star of its system, and the days were 37 hours long. There were 35 major continents and almost 100 smaller ones, though the entire planet was governed by a singular ruling body. The total population was estimated by Zalan military officials to be around 100 billion, with another 5 billion or so scattered across nearby planets and moons. They had forward military bases in other star systems on the way to Zala,
but none of the planets were particularly hospitable, and as such they were merely used as stopovers. The data packet was surprisingly light on Sorin history. The tactical information was highly detailed, but in terms of the actual history of Sora as a society, not much was to be found. There was a sparse timeline that started with a brief note about the invention of interstellar travel with attached scientific notes Lucas didn't understand. A note said something about a machine uprising that didn't go into detail. After that was a huge chunk of time with absolutely nothing listed. And then suddenly the discovery and invasion of Zala appeared out of nowhere, with a litany of battles marking them many years after. The data file contained much to look through, but Lucas would have thought that the Zalans would know their enemies in and out, and would have an infinite amount of information about them. Instead, there seemed to be pretty large knowledge gaps that didn't make sense for a race with such advanced technological capabilities. Lucas tossed the data display over to Noah, who was delighted to have a second colorful plaything. Lucas thought of their own upcoming timeline. 5 months aboard the Ark? It was barely a week ago that he reached Portland, and though he was growing more accustomed to his new extraterrestrial surroundings, it was still a long stretch of time, and the vessel was not that big. Stuck with a baby that had now figured out how to cry, a woman who had almost killed him on a few occasions, and an alien with an assumed death wish, it was going to be an interesting ride.
Chapter 14.
In their own personal tunnel through space-time, there was little to disturb them. Far from the whirlwind of the first week, the Ark and its inhabitants were now in a place of relative calm. No cannibals, no drones, no stealth cruisers or alien warlords. Their journey was no longer a race, but merely a drift, outside the bounds of physical space. On the other side of the passageway, they could find anything, but for now they were allowed some sort of reprieve. It had been a few weeks since they'd activated the core and started the final leg of their journey toward Sora. Lucas had a routine down that kept him sane and healthy. He was slowly adjusting to the 37-hour clock of Sora, as Alpha told him that his 24-hour cycle would hinder his ability to function there, and though it exhausted him at first, he found sleeping 15 of the hours gave him enough energy to stay awake the other 22. He kept to his appropriated mattress and sheets, and hadn't dared go back to the pods for fear of what visions might plague him. After he woke up and dressed in the water chamber, he ingested his first nutrient vial. As he and Asha refused to sleep in the pods, Alpha gave them portable inhalant devices that shot the nutrients straight into their lungs, where they were then filtered into their bloodstream. It was almost entirely tasteless, but there was a musty iron smell that took some getting used to. Water was still plentiful, but a few of the tanks were starting to drain noticeably as the core drew on them for power. From the looks of it, they should have enough to last the months required, but the exact calculation of that fact Lucas left to Alpha. When breakfast was over, Lucas began the first of a few workout regimens he'd crafted to help him pass the long, sunless days. Though there was no more solid food to be found on the ship since they'd gone through the last of the canned goods, the constant supply of nutrient packs allowed him to return to a healthy weight. By the end of his journey to Portland, he had wasted away to almost nothing, and he was lucky to be able to walk a few miles a day in the heat. But now, with proteins, vitamins, and whatever the hell else was flowing through his system, he did dozens of wind sprints down the metal-grated hallway of the water chamber, aided by a pair of athletic shoes he'd looted from the mansion. When he was winded, he dropped and did as many military push-ups as he could manage, and the number was increasing daily. There was an overhanging section of the wall he managed to use for pull-ups, and it had taken him a week of recovery to even manage a pair of them. He cycled in various other isometric exercises he remembered from high school football camp decades earlier, and would repeat variants of the routine two more times before the day was over. After downing two full cylinders of water after his workout, Lucas headed upstairs to the barracks to check on Noah. The prison cell nursery had been abandoned when it became clear that Noah loved sleeping in the pod Alpha had laid out for him. He slept soundly through the night, every night, which was stunning for a child his age. Lucas assumed he took to the pod because he had no real memories that could haunt him. The system was a godsend, as it allowed him to wake up rested, fed, and happy each morning,
and the gaseous nutrients meant few messy diapers. On this particular day, Lucas brought him a new holographic toy Alpha had thrown together in minutes. It was the size of a tennis ball and had colorful symbols that shot out of all sides when it was touched. Lucas threw it up in the air and the symbols disappeared, and when he caught it, they immediately sprang out again, which pleased Noah greatly, and he reached for it with outstretched arms. His burns had continued to heal, but Alpha warned that without more advanced medical supplies, they would likely never fully disappear, and the child would be permanently marked by his former planet. After handing him the ball, Lucas stepped over the welded storage cubes that made up a makeshift playpen, and the child remained enraptured by his new plaything. Alpha had been spending a large amount of time in the lab, which was now unlocked as he didn't mind visitors while he was working. Lucas supposed Zalans craved interaction like any other creature, and Alpha was doing his best not to fall back into isolation the way he had been before the pair of them came along. Lucas was glad for the company as well.
"What's the project today, Alpha?"
Lucas asked as he came in through the main door. Though the lab was always open, the door across from it remained permanently locked.
"Something that should prove useful when we reach our destination," he replied.
He didn't have his power tools out today, but rather was programming something onto a small chip, like the one Lucas had used for holo training.
"What is it?"
Alpha held up his hand, the chip levitating a couple of inches above it. Lucas still didn't understand how it did that. Some sort of magnetic trick? He grabbed it from Alpha's outstretched claw.
"It is the entirety of the Sorin language translated into English. This program will help you master it, and you should be fluent in a short period of time, as should Asha."
He presented a second, identical chip.
"When we do finally make contact, I imagine the Sorins would be far more receptive to you if you know the language 87.3% of their people speak."
Lucas left Alpha to his tinkering and headed up a level to the armory where Asha was sure to be found. He entered the large room and found a familiar sight, her reassembling yet another one of their confiscated cannibal weapons. "Don't you ever get tired of that?" Lucas asked. "Keeps me sane," she said, not lifting her head to acknowledge his presence. She was wearing a dark green tank top and a pair of white cropped pants streaked with grease. And she was barefoot as usual. She too had been regaining some of her lost strength, and was not as rail-thin as she once was. Her arms looked noticeably more muscular, and he'd seen her bench-pressing storage cubes on occasion when he came by to visit. She never asked for a spotter. The room was far more organized than when Lucas first came across it. The guns they'd taken from the village had all been carefully cleaned and organized by caliber, matched with appropriate ammunition that filled cubes on the ground. The three sets of Zalan power armor they'd taken hung on racks with the energy weapons propped up next to them. Though they'd all been meticulously polished by Asha, none of them were working as they hadn't yet gotten Alpha's attention. Lucas tossed the chip at Asha, who caught it instinctively. "What's this?"
"Time to learn how to speak Sorin."
Asha rolled her eyes. "We have to learn their damn language. I already speak Hindi and French. Can't Alpha just make us a pair of those translator necklaces?" Three languages? Lucas had almost failed out of AP Spanish in 12th grade. "You really want to sound like a robot like him? Besides, what else do you have to do?" Asha looked down at the gun she was rebuilding for the fourth time. "All right," she said. She stood up and walked past Lucas toward the far side of the room. "While you're here, come take a look at this." She picked up a heavy cube full of ammo and set it on the ground. It had been sitting on another larger storage device, one with a holographic lock on it. "I found this hiding in the corner here once I finally got this place sorted out. I've tried everything under the sun with those controls, and I cannot get it open." A few bullet indentations near the display indicated she'd tried more than just sifting through the lock's display. A machete lay on the ground next to the cube, snapped cleanly in half. Lucas had become more accustomed to the design of Zalan displays, but as he attempted to unlock the container, he was met with multiple flashes of angry red. He couldn't translate the symbols that appeared when he failed, but he understood their general meaning, warning him to back off.
"I have no idea. You should ask Alpha."
She sat down on the cube and put her feet up on another container nearby, filled with belt-fed light machine gun ammo. I'm wondering if he's the one who put it there. If his friends cleared the place out before they abandoned ship, why wouldn't they have taken it with them? Lucas didn't have an answer to that. Anyway, Asha said, I'm going to go check on the kid. Over near her bed was a floating monitor that showed a view of Noah rolling around in the barracks. Lucas had a similar display in his own quarters that he could bring up to keep an eye on him. Asha marched out of the room before Lucas could say another word, and there was more grease on the back of her pants than the front. Their relationship wasn't what Lucas would call friends, but they were getting dangerously close to colleagues as their recent battles had forced them to pull together and, at the very least, allowed them to trust each other to a certain degree. In the weeks after their brief moment of personal revelation about her harrowing childhood and his lost son, they hadn't talked much about themselves. Sticking to the safe topics of the Ark, Alpha, Noah, Zala, Sora, and intergalactic war. Lucas arrived in the CIC and stared at his primary source of entertainment these past few weeks, the captain's chair. With over 20 hours a day to kill, he'd finished his combat flight school holo training, completing all 33 levels of the program for the Ark's ship class. Even when unplugged, his brain whirred with flight formations and intercept tactics. Growing tired of attempting to best his highest scores in the simulator, he thought about trying to learn how to fly a virtual fighter instead of a transport, but at the moment he had a new program to investigate. The chip flew immediately into the console when he released it, and familiar cables sprung out and attached themselves to his temples. The rush of information was something he was slowly getting used to, but this was his first experience with an entirely new type of program. There were no virtual spacecraft or foreign moons to fly around. Rather, his field of vision exploded with a countless array of geometric symbols. It took him a moment, but he began to understand what he was looking at. The Soran language. A voice began speaking in English, and he was stunned to find that it was actually his own. Welcome to Basic Soran, it said calmly, sounding exactly as he did. Lucas was puzzled, but then something clicked and he understood. With no other English speakers around, Alpha must have taken a speech sample from one of their many conversations and used some sort of editing technology to allow him to say anything he wanted. He programmed it as a virtual guide for Lucas, as surely the lesson would be easier when he could already hear himself speaking the unfamiliar words. All he had to do was copy. An hour or so with the audio tutorial, and Lucas thought he was getting the basics down quite well. The language didn't sound like any he'd heard on Earth. It wasn't as slow as an American drawl, nor as intense as Japanese or Chinese. It lacked the flow of any Romance language, nor did it have the unpronounceable sounds of Arabic or African tongues. It was entirely unique, but Lucas, aided by his own voice, was learning to assemble simple phrases with ease. It was that good old neural stimulation at work again, allowing him to process information at light speed, but he wondered how much he could retain when the program was shut down. The tutorial broke from its audio lesson and turned to a visual representation of the language, the geometric symbols from earlier, which looked far different than the Zalan words scattered through the ship. These icons were clean and organized, while Zalan was more primal and almost hieroglyphic. As Virtual Lucas talked Actual Lucas through the layout of letters and words, he began to understand. Each sound corresponded with a shape. An O sound was a square, a U a circle, an A a triangle, and so on. Non-vowel sounds had more complex shapes. When they were combined into a word, the different sound shapes assembled themselves into one complicated glyph. If you knew what each shape meant, you could read the word. It took Lucas far longer to catch on to this system than when he'd heard the language audibly. But after a few hours, he was creating his own symbols by drawing them in the air, his finger turned into a virtual pen by the program. Eventually, he grew tired of the sound of his own voice droning on about the intricacies of Soran grammar, and spent another hour trying to top his best score in the particularly difficult level of 28 transport training exercise that required him to dodge enemy ships while weaving through a canyon only a few meters wider than his craft. He had to decrease his speed to not crash, but too often he would slow down so much that his overall marks would suffer because of it.
Having just shot down two fighters on his tail, he was on pace for his best score yet, but a surprise blast into the side of the canyon wall caused him to lose focus and clip a nearby rock pillar. The damn program changed each time he ran it, and there was never any predicting what would happen next. He spiraled out of control and felt a familiar jolt of pain when his ship was dashed into a million pieces on the red rocky surface. "God damn it," he said audibly, and shut down the program in frustration. He got up from the chair and paced around, but soon his anger subsided. Even after using the chair for hours, he wasn't nearly as fatigued as he used to be, and he assumed his body was forming some sort of bridge with the device. His neurological system was growing accustomed to